All right, let's open our Bibles tonight. Psalm 46. We are currently in the books of wisdom and poetry. They are named that because they do not move the history of Israel forward. In fact, most of the historical books are finished early on, and then we get these books of wisdom, then the minor and the major prophets, which plug back into that history, and really only Malachi takes us forward historically after the historical books. But from Job through to the Song of Solomon, they are all books that are written in the present tense. They are poetic in Hebrew forms. They use a lot of comparison and contrast. In English, you might put an exclamation point behind something when you really mean it, or on the computer, if you're blogging, you capitalize everything. In Hebrew, they just repeat themselves. So if you read things like, six things God hates, no, seven are an abomination to him, that's a Hebrew exclamation point. And you will find a lot of those things as we go through these things, but especially in the Psalms, and there's a lot of them, and tonight will be a third of the way through them. We've been taking five a night. We will probably take more than that towards the end of the book, and except for Psalm 119, we won't. That's a long one. But Psalms tend to become a place where you listen in both to the worship and to the prayers of others. And where they might have been prayed in private, God puts them on public display. Now, he doesn't do that just to satisfy your curiosity, but he does do that to bring you to a place where you can pray in your situation like they did in theirs. And especially when you know the circumstance for the psalm, it makes such a helpful way to study about, you know, how is my prayer life and what can I tell the Lord about? What should I not say? People, oftentimes as young Christians, they go to pray and they pretend like they're really serious, you know, or they're really going to be devout, and in their heart they're thinking one thing, but their mouth is saying other things. And the Lord knows. You can't really fake God out, you know, by the way, oh Lord, I'm just so thankful to be here. And you know that you're not. Better you just be honest, you know. But you get a lot of insight into worship and how the Lord works and how the men of God and the women of God in the Old Testament sought the Lord. Tonight we have three Psalms, 46, 47, and 48, that are all rooted in one large event in Jewish history. And that event happened during the reign of Hezekiah and his ministry in Jerusalem, which is found for the most part in 2 Kings 18 and 19. And it is all about that Assyrian overthrow where the Lord in one night killed 185,000 Assyrians who were hell-bent on killing the Jews and destroying their city. Psalm 49 is very an unlikely psalm. It is more of a proverb, but it is a psalm of instruction on the futility of falling in love with riches. It makes great argument. And chapter 50 is one of those messianic psalms that say much about our coming king. As in most biblical prophecy, there is always both a near and a far-term application. And when there is a far-term application, it is usually because the Lord has told us that there would be. And the psalm is particularly quoted somewhere else. There's obviously a reason to write, and then there's a prophecy to point out. And so when we get to those, we'll point those out. And especially as we get to like Psalm 65, 75, 85, they become a lot more messianic in the sense of they begin to prophesy more than anything else about the coming kingdom and the coming rule. And there's a whole section of those psalms that seem to speak of just when the Lord comes, what will he do? How will he act? What will we expect? And you get a lot of good insight into what you may not have found otherwise in the New Testament. So we'll begin with chapter 46. To the chief musician, a psalm of the sons of Korah, a song for Alamoth. When the Assyrian army had swept south from Syria, they swallowed up the entire northern kingdom then called Israel in 722 BC. And the Assyrians had really plots and plans to rule the world, but in order to really be known for that, they would have to take out the Egyptians, who were super strong at the time. And so they decided that they would head down south through the middle of Israel, Samaria region, conquer one city at a time, take out Jerusalem, and then from there just jump through the Sinai to Egypt and be the rulers and the conquerors of the world. And Sennacherib, who was the king, if you will, or the ruler, really thought he could pull this off. The Assyrians, according to history, didn't kill many people. They maimed a whole bunches of them, though, and they were such a brutal army, they would come in front of your family, cut off your arm, and then bandage it up and say, I hope I don't have to come back. And they didn't. Whole cities would surrender because of fear. And so they were a very intimidating group. When Hezekiah first came to the throne and he began to reorganize Israel to a nation again that would worship God, Sennacherib was coming around the mountain, so to speak. And Hezekiah did the wrong thing. He sent him a huge chunk of, you know, Jerusalem cash to try to turn the guy away. And the king took it and then said, thank you for the money, but I'm coming anyway. And Hezekiah realized that he should have been seeking the Lord. And as he was having second thoughts, Sennacherib thought, why should I leave Jerusalem untouched so I can rule the world? And so he sent his mouthpiece, a guy named Rabshakeh, to Jerusalem because it was such a large walled city, very well protected, and began to demand in Hebrew that the Jews surrender. And he argued with them in their own language, yelling over the wall, you know, there hasn't been a city yet whose God has been able to protect them. You might know or hear about the Samaritan villages that are now under our control. The entire north is gone. We rule. And we're coming. And we'll be here today or we'll be here tomorrow, but we're coming. So don't let Hezekiah tell you to trust God or pray or that kind of stuff. It doesn't work with anybody else. It won't work with you. And day in and day out, this guy just leaned heavy upon the people. And the people, for the most part, had been led for years by ungodly men. And so the relationship with God was poor. But Hezekiah wanted to change that. And he stood his ground. Sennacherib was eventually called away as they went off to another battle, but even then, he sent a letter to Hezekiah and Isaiah, and he took it in front of the Lord at the temple and spread it out, and they prayed, and they returned and began to besiege Jerusalem, and one night, you know the story, God delivered them as 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. Can you imagine that number outside your walls on every side? Were slaughtered by one angel. And Jerusalem woke up to think that they were dead, only to find out that they would live. And who was dead? The Assyrians were dead. It was phenomenal. To commemorate the victory, this hymn was penned, Psalm 46. Maybe Hezekiah wrote it, possibly Isaiah the prophet or someone at that time, but it's one of those psalms of victory that speak of how God can handle the worst of trials. It was Luther's favorite psalm. And he would sing it constantly, especially when he was in the battle for the time of the Reformation and the discouragement came too much. And him and his buddy Philip would just sing this psalm and had written music to it. So the psalmist writes, God is our refuge and our strength, and he is a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even if the earth is moved and the mountains are carried into the midst of the sea, and if the waters roar and are troubled and the mountains shake with their swelling, because God is our refuge and he's our strength. You know, politics didn't work. Bribes didn't work. The alliances that other nations had made to try to protect themselves from the Assyrians hadn't worked, because people can't protect you. God can't. God will protect you from heartache and from failure and from sin and from disaster. He only can do what no one else can. And if there was ever a people that learned that, it were the folks stuck in the city for several years as the Assyrians beat the drums outside. God is our refuge. It's a word that means a place of shelter to which I can go from the outside in. But the word strength is not an outside term, it's an inner one. Not only can I run and hide myself in the Lord, but God will give me the inner fortitude to face the calamity by faith. It's not enough to just run to the Lord. You want God to do something in your life. We don't want to hang on with bleeding fingernails, you know. We want to rest. And sometimes God shields us from what is going on around us. We'll read in Psalm 91, the Lord will say of the calamities of the saints, 1,000 will fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand. It won't come near you. Your eyes will look and see the reward of the wicked. That is sometimes the way God gets you out of trials. But there are other times that he just leaves you there and you having to stand by faith. And you're afflicted and you suffer and you're in trouble. Notice a very present help in time of trouble, but the word it means tight places or I'm in dire straits. And Hezekiah and the the people in Jerusalem had nowhere to turn. You can't run when there's 185,000 people around you. You can't hide. But in cataclysmic times, verse 2 and verse 3, when the mountains carry out to the sea, when the earth is moved and the waters roar, all of them very poetic words to say the very foundations of my life are being moved, God can still come through. I don't know if Hezekiah would have told you that the day before the angel went to work, but he was able to write this the day after. God can do it over overwhelming odds. You know, I remember years ago reading Elizabeth Elliot's story. You know, her first husband, Jim Elliot, was killed by the Aka Indians in Ecuador as he was trying to reach them with the gospel. And in the midst of ministry, he was slaughtered. She got married again to a fellow named Addison Leach, who died of a very slow, painful cancer death. And so she struggled, first to losing a husband that was just serving God, the other who was just ill and stayed ill for quite some time. But as she wrote her memoirs, she brought this psalm up and she said, verse 1 and verse 10, my life psalms. The Lord is my strength and he's my refuge, your very present help in trouble. I should be still and know that he's God. And so she hung on to these promises, and no doubt, you know, no disaster, whether it's natural or otherwise, can ever move God from his place as our refuge and strength. You know, if there's something tearing you up or worrying you or making you lose sleep, you just got to go read the first three verses and then hit that Selah button there, you know? Stop and think about this. You know, let this be the snooze button. God is going to handle what I can't. And you can commit it to memory and you can wrap it around your heart, because there couldn't have been a worse, more challenging and daunting threat than 185,000 soldiers outside armed to the hilt that had all of the time in the world, and you ran out of food and you ran out of water and you ran out of hope, and you had a king and a prophet and a couple of other folks on their face night and day saying, God, come on. And everyone said, let's surrender before they start hacking arms off and taking off our legs, before they get in here and hurt us real bad. No, let's wait upon the Lord. It's a battle, all right, but you get to eventually sing Psalm 46. Doesn't matter what happens, God is my refuge and strength, present help. In verse 4, we read, there is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High, and God is in the midst of her, so she shall not be moved. And God will help her just at the breaking of the dawn. While the nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, and the earth melted. The Lord of hosts, he's with us, and the God of Jacob, he's our refuge. Knowing the Assyrians were coming, Hezekiah had done more than just live by faith and prayer. He had done some practical things to assure that the people would have some longevity. And the greatest interest of any city is to have water. You know, you can be a walled city, but if you don't have water, you're done. And so even in Israel, if you go on one of the tours, you will always find the tells, or the mounds that have been covered up where the old cities were. They are always on the high ground for protection and near a water source for life. And if there is no water source, you can forget about digging in the hill. People didn't live there for long. It wouldn't be worth digging up. So Hezekiah diverted waters outside the city from the Gihon Springs through solid rock, some 1,777 feet, people digging on both sides. And they did a far better job than they do on the street out here. They met together and accomplished it in due time. The spring was hidden, so the enemy didn't know they were getting water, and Hezekiah's tunnel, as it came to be known, you can still walk through in Israel. Now, we don't usually take people through it because it gets very confining and people get claustrophobic, and you're in water up to your waist sometimes, and it's cold and it's dark and it's, you know, a third of a mile, and people, oh, that's okay, I'll just wait here. But it's cool, you can go through. And they only missed by about, I don't know, what, 6 inches, I think? And they just nailed it. So Hezekiah went out and did his part, but he admits that it was God in their midst, notice, verse 4, who gave them the victory, and that the Lord of hosts was with them. By the way, in the Bible, God the Father is always called the fountain of living water, and Jesus is spoken of as the well of living water, and the Holy Spirit is spoken of as the river of living water. So when God gets involved, you get wet. You know? He provides, man, that spiritual power. And even if the enemy encircles us to cut us off, God is with us. Jesus dwells in our heart. The Holy Spirit is upon us. No enemy can stop his flow to our lives. The key is whether he dwells within your heart or not. Now, though that is indeed the present tense application, the prophetic view, because this is later used in Isaiah and other places, is also a promise of the fact that one day the Lord Jesus will come to Jerusalem, and when his foot lands upon the Mount of Olives, it'll be split in two, and out from the throne upon which he'll sit will run a river, all the way from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea, healing everything in its path, bringing life to whatever it touches, so that in En-Gedi, where today there is nothing but a Dead Sea, there will be fishermen drying their nets, according to the scriptures. And this verse that applied first to that work of Hezekiah and the preserving work of God and bringing the waters to be is a verse that will eventually be applied to the Lord, who will bring life to everyone and everything around him. It applies to us today. You know, as the Holy Spirit moves in, there's a stream of life, and it makes glad the people of God. So one day the Lord will see the nations of the earth gathered against him, and by the word of his mouth they'll be defeated, and the Antichrist, their leader, will be thrown in the abuso, and the Lord will then set up shop. And the first thing he's going to do is develop some irrigation, bring some water. And I'll tell you, if you've been to Israel, they need water. They all talk about water. We got a lot of rain. We're so glad we got water. They got collection basins just to throw it into the water. It's always the battle with the Syrians for the water and the battle with the Lebanese for the water. But one day when the Lord comes, no battle. He's just going to bring the water with him. And so we read here that the Lord of hosts is with us. So come, verse 8, you should come and behold the work of the Lord, who has made desolation in the earth. He makes wars to cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two and burns the chariot in the fire. So God had brought deliverance to Jerusalem. But again, this is a future promise when the Lord comes and all war stops. But its primary application, first and foremost, is to this deliverance that was brought. Come and see what God has done. Don't you think that for the next many years throughout the land, the one thing everyone was going to talk about were all those dead Assyrians? Did they eat something? Was there something in the air? Was there a natural? No, it was the Lord. And you just know people were going to say, no, it can't be the Lord. He wouldn't do that. And yet he did. How often Hezekiah had been chided by the people for his faith, especially as the Assyrian army closed in, and yet God says he'll win the battle for us. So you read in verse 11, the Lord of hosts is with us. You read it again in verse 11, in 7 and verse 11. Look, God was with us. He was our refuge. Remember, we started with that in verse 1. And in verse 10, it just says, you should be still and know that I'm God, that I'll be exalted among the nations. I'll be exalted in the earth. And the Lord who heads up the hosts of the angel, one angel took out 185,000. So I wouldn't worry if there were 10 angels around, would you? And the God who took Jacob in his failures and loved him to life did so as well for these that were failing, because there were not many in Jerusalem that had faith. Were it left to a vote, they would have given up. But there was no voting. Hezekiah was leading. And he led them in the ways of the Lord. Psalm 47 just continues that same thought. Now imagine the scene, and I've had, just when you walk around Jerusalem sometimes when you're in Israel, you get the feel for, the valleys being filled with soldiers. But as far as your eye could see, there would be men that just looked up to you up a 20, 25 foot wall and said, I'm going to kill you. I'm coming for you and your children, your wife and your family. And they were, they were troops that had murdered many. They were able to bring scaling ladders and battering rams, and the Assyrians all wore these ugly beards, according at least to old historicals. They looked like just mean-spirited guys, which obviously they were. And if they couldn't get in, they were going to starve you out. But one way or another, they were going to pillage and plunder and maim and destroy. And the time for talk was over, and they came to give one last offer, and Hezekiah refused. I'm not giving in. And so everyone went to bed. And you can read there in Kings how, everyone seemed to go to bed for the last night, like, we'll just try to sleep because tomorrow we're done. They had gotten that close. God had let it go that long. You feel like that sometimes when you're praying and the Lord does nothing? And it's like, tomorrow, Lord. Like he doesn't know. I always wanted to send the Lord a watch. I always thought the Lord was dragging his feet and everything I prayed for. Come on, Lord, what in the world? Why do you want to wait so long? You know, you should answer me now. I know it's a year from now, but this will take it off my mind. This will be great, you know? Well, he didn't with these folks. He made them wait till the bitter end. And Hezekiah and Isaiah didn't sleep that night. To them, it was a night of tremendous praying. And then in the morning, as they looked over the wall, the din and the noise and the clamoring and the clattering of 185,000 troops were gone. And someone said, I don't hear anything. Well, that can't be good. And I don't know who the sucker was, you know, that got picked to go out and look. It's your turn. No, yes it is, you know. But the poor guy went out to find death in the camp. Food sitting on the table. Not a single arrow was fired. Not a single man was lost. Can you imagine when he came back to the door and said, it's all clear, I took care of it. Yeah, there's about 185,000 dead as far as I could count. You know, it's been a rough morning. And they went from sure death to sure life. Is it any small wonder to you that this psalm is read seven times prior to the blowing of the trumpets to signal the beginning of every Jewish New Year? They sing this one seven times. The psalm of celebration and praise to the King of the earth. The short view, again, Jerusalem and its deliverance. The long view, the Lord reigning in the millennium. Revelation, what is that? Chapter 11, somewhere. Where the seventh angel sounds and there's a loud voice in heaven and you hear the kingdoms of the world have become the kingdoms of his Lord and of his Christ. He's going to reign forever and ever. Verse 15, maybe, of Revelation 11. So that's the long view, and here's the short view. Now you have both views. Oh, clap your hands, all you people, and shout to God with a voice of triumph, for the Lord Most High is awesome. He's a great king over all of the earth. He subdues people under us, the nations under our feet. He will choose our inheritance for us, the excellence of Jacob, whom he loves. I'm always amazed how quickly we are not very grateful. I think one of the good reasons to travel around the world or get out if you can on your vacation is so you can come home and be grateful. You are blessed. And of all of the places in the world that I've ever gone, I can tell you with great assurance, this is the best country in the world to live in. We have it the easiest. We are the most blessed of people. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we're the most spiritual, but we're blessed. But I read this and I think, why would anybody need to say to the people, hey, come on, let's clap. 185,000 dead Assyrians, you're going to live. Come on, let's clap. I don't know. I'm not a real clapping person, you know. I'm kind of subdued. I mean, if there was ever a time to clap, and if Hezekiah wrote this, it almost sounds like he's beside himself. Come on, man. Shout unto God with a voice of triumph. We have just won the battle. Our God is good. Come on, clap. I've always thought that American Christians are the worst worshipers in the world. If you ever had a chance to go to the Philippines, a man sing in the Philippine churches, those folks can sing. And in Eastern Europe and Hungary at the Bible College, kids that had nothing, when we were out doing the Bible College in Hungary a few years ago, teaching pastors, we went 3 days without food. There was no food to be had and no one to bring it. And you went to worship, and no one said, I'm hungry. They just said, could we sing that song again? And they got into it. There was worship. I think our complacency is often because we have so much. So we're not easily satisfied, are we? We're always wanting a little bit more. You know, come on, give me a little more. You know, I got the HD in the three rooms now, but I'd like to get it out in the garage where I could work on the car, you know, and watch the game. And we just don't ever get enough. But I'm amazed. It's almost like the 10 lepers, you know. You get a new job, you're married, you have wonderful children, the Lord is using your life, you're saved, you're going to heaven. Come on, clap. I don't know, you know, it seems so demonstrative. I'm not really that Pentecostal, you know. All right. Go to a basketball game, you're screaming your guts out. Go to a Ducks are in the playoffs, that ought to get you going. Yeah, get people in church, and no, don't make me clap. I'm really, really bad at it anyway. And, well, if you're not going to sing, I don't know who can. The Lord Most High is awesome. El Elyon, God who possesses heaven and earth. Which is, by the way, El Elyon is the millennial title that God gives himself in the New Testament. God Most High. A great king. Which, by the way, are the same words of title that was assumed by every Assyrian king. The great king. Rabshakeh used it as he sought to belittle the God of the Jews. I am a great king. Okay, Rabshakeh, you're dead. And Sennacherib went home and he was finished. Only the God of Israel remained. He is a great God. And in the end, he stands while the dust settles, he wins. So if that'll, you know, get you to shout with a voice of triumph and clap your hands, I think Christians ought to sing at the top of their lungs. We ought to be the most vocal people around, but we're pretty dissatisfied and we're not easily, you know, amused. And that's too bad. Because any of these other places you'll go where you'll find the church singing at the top of the lungs are places where the church has little to go on except their spiritual well-being. But it's enough for them. And I think that the Lord can work when we start to be grateful for what we have. We have so much to be thankful for. And so did these in Jerusalem. But notice, come on, clap. He still had, it's still a order that had to be given, which is real sad. He will subdue the people, verse 3, the nations, and choose our inheritance. And he had delivered these folks. You know, looking down over the prophetic line, there will come a time, according to the prophets, when all of the nations of the world will gather in Megiddo to fight God and seek to rule him out. And it is then that out of the sky will come the great king. And his army and every knee will bow, and every nation in the millennium will acknowledge Israel and its king, and by the word of his mouth the people will be subdued. So there is the near term and the far term. The excellence of Jacob, whom he loves. The word excellence is the word for pride, because in the last days God will take great pride in Israel and exhibit himself through them. So, verse 6, sing praises to God. Come, sing praises. We sing this song, don't we? Sing praises to our King. Sing praises, for God is the King of all of the earth. Sing praises and do so with understanding. Very important. You can't just sing. You got to know why. He reigns over the nation. He sits on his holy throne. The princes of the people gather together, the people of the God of Abraham, for the shields of the earth belong to the Lord. He is greatly exalted. So in that picture, we're given then one final psalm here, Psalm 48, to commemorate this great deliverance. And it carries the thought further to the end of the coming of the Lord to rule, when the army of the beast will be destroyed, and it is foreshadowed in this Assyrian slaughter of the angels at the hand of God. We don't know whether this was written by Hezekiah or Isaiah or another. It really doesn't matter. Because the focus is upon, you know, the worship that we would take up with God because we're so grateful to belong to him and how miraculously he worked. Do you remember what you were like before you got saved? You weren't all that lovable, I would suspect. And yet overnight, in a moment, God changed your life. I went Thursday to a Bible study in Bellflower to pick up some pot. But the guy who was selling me the pot had gotten saved the Thursday before. He set me up. Yeah, come on in. There's a little study going. Afterwards, we can talk. What? Yeah, a little study. Oh, you'll like, just sit over there. You'll be great. Got saved. The guy hustled me right into the kingdom is what he did. But I went home without the pot and with the Lord. I knocked on my neighbor's door. I said, hey, I want to tell you I got saved. Because he'd been a Christian guy witnessing to me. He said, get away from me. You're mocking me. And he slammed the door in my face. Because I'd always make fun of him and call him names. I said, no, dude, really. I really got saved. I'm not kidding. Yeah, tell me next week. And so I told him next week. So we read in verse 1, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God and in his holy mountain, and beautiful in elevation, and the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, that city of the great king, where God is in her palaces, and he is known as her, there's that same word again, place of hiding, refuge. The near view, back to the Assyrian battle and the assault on the city of God, which by the way is Jerusalem, and later in the prophecy it will be the new Jerusalem. And it is written as being beautiful for situations. If you've ever have, like I said, back to Israel again, but if you ever have a chance to go, Jerusalem is a great place to pick. You know, no one could hardly take the Jebusites out of Jerusalem because they were so powerful. Such a well-defended city, except for the north. It is protected on all sides by very steep cliffs. There's really no way to sneak up on them. It's a mountain city. God put his name there. And because God chose it, it is different from every capital city in the world. In the years to come, the only conquering people able to take the city were able to do so because God abandoned it. When the Babylonians would come in, Ezekiel in chapter 8 said, I was sitting and watching the temple, and he watched the glory cloud of God's glory departing. And it went from the inner court to the outer court. It hovered for a time, waiting for repentance. It went in chapter 10 of Ezekiel to the east gate. And finally, in chapter 11, it went up and over the Mount of Olives, and the Lord just disappeared. And when the Lord pulled up his stakes, the Babylonians came in, and within 5 years, laid it waste. But the Assyrians, who came much earlier, failed to take into account that this was the mountain of his holiness. This is where God sat. This was the place that the people took refuge in him. He was still in the palace, so there was no chance they were getting there. The sides of the north, by the way, is a very interesting term, because if you've ever had to take any mythology classes in college, the sides of the north, by just their terminology, was the place where the gods lived. So the Assyrians, who were certainly heathens, believed, no doubt, hearing those terms, that that would be the legendary place of the gods. In Isaiah chapter 14, verse 13, it was the place that Satan longed to sit, describing the throne of God in heaven. Here it speaks of God's home upon the earth. So are you. But Chernekhov might have thought twice before attacking a place where even his mythology said the gods lived. Oh, more than the gods, the God lived. And so we read there in verse 3 that Hezekiah wasn't trusting in the massive city walls or in the secret water supply, but in the Lord, his place of refuge. And so to all the propaganda, he just cried, in God we trust. For behold, the kings had assembled, passed by together. They saw it, they marveled, they were troubled, they hastened away. Fear took hold of them as pain of a woman in birth pangs, and when you break the ships of Tarshish, as when you break the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. As we have heard, so we have seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God, God will establish it forever. And so the people that heard and saw this Assyrian slaughter, not only did it make the Jews very confident in their God for a time, but it brought terror upon people. And the destruction had come like a bad storm at sea, a fierce east winds that just wiped out the ships that were coming from Tarshish or England. We've heard it, we've seen it. God will establish it. The lesson is learned. So we have thought, O God, on your loving kindness in the midst of the temple. So they went to worship. And according to your name, O God, it is your praise to the ends of the earth, your right hand filled with righteousness. Let Mount Zion rejoice and the daughters of Judah be glad because of your judgment. And walk about Zion and go through her and count her towers and mark well her bulwarks and consider her palaces so you can tell it to the next generation. This is God, our God forever. He will be our guide even to death. So we're not going to back up again. I think that with all of the heathen cities, you know, during that time in their gods, Nineveh, Babylon, Egypt, verse 11 says, let Mount Zion rejoice. The people were rejoicing. There wasn't any damage to the city. He had guided them to the brink of death and delivered them. He would see them through it all. The city was free. So come and walk. Check it out. Walk around. Tell the next generation what you remember happening here. Beautiful songs of God's victory. We would do well to go back and I think remember chapter 46. God is our refuge, very present help in time of trouble. Psalm 49, you could entitle the psalm, You Can't Take It With You. It's an anonymous psalm about how poor rich people are. And Jesus tells a story in Luke, what is it, chapter 12, right? About the wealthy fellow who had so much stuff coming in. So prosperous, he decided he'd build some bigger storage rooms, right? And then retire early and have some fun. And the Lord said, fool, tonight you die. Presumed a little too much. Look, riches is not a sin. There's plenty of rich people in the Bible. Trusting in them, though, is a sin. Money is not the root of all evil. You need it to live. But the love of it is. And it is not a psalm that is normal. It's almost like a proverb because it focuses on how empty riches are, and it makes great comparisons. And we read in verse 1, and we don't know who wrote this or can we place it anywhere, but it just stands up by itself as a good lesson. Hear this, all people, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth can speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart can give you understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb and disclose my dark sayings upon the harp. So I call for everyone to listen, saints and sinners alike. And I would say Western Christianity, because we are the most materialistic country in the world, certainly. If not, we're running close neck and neck with a few others. And then he says, why should I fear in the days of evil when the iniquity at my heels surrounds me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast in the multitude of the riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of their soul is costly. It shall cease forever, that he should continue to live eternally and not see the pit. So he starts by saying, let me sing you a song that's going to be kind of heavy. The blues, if you will, on the harp. I'll sing a dark saying on the harp. That's the blues, I think. And then he starts right off by saying, you know, it's really foolish to trust your wealth. And the obvious truth is you can't save a person from death. Salvation is a cost you can't afford. Only God pays that price. You know, years ago, the French atheist Voltaire wrote his best-selling satirical attack on Christianity called Candide. And he just went all out, just criticizing faith and the Lord. But when he was dying, he offered any doctor who could extend his life for 6 months all of his fortune. And he just died. It didn't work. A rich man may be able to bribe a judge. He can't bribe God. He can get the best medical care if you're rich, but you're still going to die. Duh. And there's no resources whatsoever to keep you out of hell. So you read. You know, you can't give to God a ransom for your soul. The redemption of the soul is costly. And it's so costly that if you're going to continue eternally and not see the pit, it's going to be quite a price to pay. But it's the price Jesus paid. You can't pay that. And then you read in verse 10, he sees the rich man. Now, he sees wise men die, and the fool and the senseless person perish, and they leave their wealth to others. And their inner thought is that their house will last forever. Their dwelling place to all generations. So they call their lands after their own names. And nevertheless, man, though in honor, he doesn't remain. He's like the beasts that perish. A man who trusts in his riches is foolish because he sees other people die, but he just assumes he'll be different. Yeah, they're going to die. I'm not. Yes, you are. Yeah, I'm going to name a building after me. I've got a longstanding legacy. Yep, you'd lived and you're dead. And the psalmist even goes so far as to say he'll leave no long-lasting legacy. He'll die like the animals. You know, he'll die in his sin. He'll die foolish. He'll die like a beast. So he says in verse 13, this is the way of those who are foolish, their posterity who approve their sayings. Not only are they foolish, but the people who aren't wealthy, but just, you know, agree with them. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death feeds upon them. The upright shall have dominion over them in the morning. Their beauty will be consumed in the grave, far from their dwelling. Get the facelift, but in the morning, look at there, beauty in the grave. Got to get my eyes lifted, my tummy tucked, and then you can die. And then you read the words, but God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, and he shall receive me. Where do you want to invest your life? Don't be afraid when someone becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased, for when he dies, he'll carry nothing away, and his glory will not descend after him. Though while he lives, he blesses himself. And men will praise you when you do well for yourself, but he shall go to the generation of his fathers, that they shall never see the light. And a man who is in honor, yet he does not understand, will be like a beast that perishes. So the glory of men is like a beast without understanding. You're going to leave it all behind. Don't worry when they get wealthy and you don't. Just praise the Lord, because but God is the only verse you want to remember. It's interesting, you know, when the Tutankhamun exhibit was here in town for a few years, we went and looked at this, you know, little 18-year-old boy who had so much stuff, it took them 10 years to unpack it once they found it. That's a lot of stuff. That's more than, you know, one of those boxes outside your garage, you know? I mean, this guy had so much junk and he was dead. Worthless wealth is a good title for the psalm. Wealth like a millstone pulling you down to hell. And I love verse 18 because it says, while he lives, he talks all about how smart he is, how great he is, how wealthy he is, all the stuff he bought. You know, we are mesmerized in our society by the cult of personality. We don't want to just hear Oprah. We want to hear how much money she has. We don't want to just hear, you know, the basketball player. We want to know what kind of crib he lives in. We don't care. You know, you can only applaud for so long before you die. And you can't take it with you. Verse 17 ought to just sober you up. You can't take it with you. So verse 20, get behind, or beyond, I should say, wealth, and get to the Lord. Because if you die without the Lord, you die like a dog. Pretty heavy verse, don't you think? But verse 15, but God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave. He can receive me. So that's all that is directional. Everything else is consequential. You have a lot of money, you have a lot of stuff. Here's the consequence. So the next time you hear the guy going, yeah, I just bought me a new Bentley. I got one of these. Yeah, okay, well, I'm going to change the channel. Thanks very much. You know, you need to know the Lord because you can't redeem your soul. All the money in the world, you ain't going to be able to redeem your soul. You're going to have to go to Jesus, who's the only one who pays the price. It's a great psalm to share with folks who are into stuff. Just pull this one out here. Let me just read Psalm 49 to you, bro. Pull the guy over with the Bentley. Hey, I got a verse for you. I just wanted to read this right here. For when he dies, he shall carry nothing away. Just meditate on that, brother. And finally, Psalm 50, a psalm of Asaph. The word means gatherer. Hezekiah's secretary, or actually the father of Hezekiah's secretary, was named Asaph. The chief Levite musician in David's time was named Asaph. But this is one of those call to judgments and warnings to the nation, and it's just really a straightforward warning of one day the Lord having the final word. So it's a good way to end tonight. Verse 1. The Mighty One, the God, the Lord, has spoken, and he has called the earth from the rising of the sun to its going down. And out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God will shine forth. No doubt prophetic. Our God shall come, shall not keep silent, as a fire that shall devour before him. It shall be very tempestuous all around him. He shall call the heavens from above, and to the earth that he may judge his people. So gather my saints together to me, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice, and let the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is the judge. So hear my people, I will speak, O Israel, and testify against you. I am God, your God. I will not rebuke you for your sacrifices or burnt offerings, which are continually before me. I will not take a bull from your house, nor goats out of your folds. Every beast of the forest is mine, cattle on a thousand hills. I know all the birds of the mountains and the wild beasts of the field. They're mine. If I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. For the world is mine in its fullness. Will I eat the flesh of bulls, drink the blood of goats, offer to God thanksgiving? Pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I'll deliver you, and you shall glorify me. So God's word to the nation is, in the near view, sacrifice is good, but God isn't interested in sacrifice as much as he is in faith. And again, like every place in the Bible, if you come with sacrifice and your heart is not right, or if you will, you don't pay the vows to the Most High. You don't come with thanksgiving. You don't call upon the Lord. You don't walk with him. All of your religious behavior is worthless to God because it all belongs to him. So anything you give him, yeah, that's mine. Here, Lord, I want to give you. Yeah, thanks, that's mine. No, I'd like to give. Yeah, thanks, that's mine. What isn't his? Well, your heart that he gave to you, and then he wants it back. But he gives you the choice. So, you know, pay your vows. Come to the Lord and offer thanksgiving and seek him when you're in trouble so he can deliver you, so you can glorify him. He wants your life to bring him honor. That's what he's dependent upon. He's not dependent upon us for anything. But he wants us humbled and faithful. To the wicked, God would say, what right have you to declare my statutes or take my covenant in your mouth, seeing you hate instruction and cast my words behind you? When you saw a thief, you consented with him. Have you also been a partaker with adulterers? You give your mouth to evil, your tongue frames deceit. You sit and speak evil against your brother and slander your own mother's son. These things you have done, and I've kept silent. You thought that I was altogether like you, but I'm going to rebuke you and set them in order before your eyes. So, hate instruction, refuse my words, consent to sin, speak evil. God hasn't done anything. He waits. Silence, by the way, is not approval. It's just God's patience. And he's not powerless. So consider this, you who forget God, verse 22, there's still time, lest I tear you in pieces and there be none to deliver you. If you offer praise that glorifies me to him who orders his conduct aright, I will show the salvation of the Lord. So, warning for the future, there's still time, choose you this day. But eventually, God, you have to answer to the Lord, don't you? Who already has everything except your life, and that he wants, because he's given his life for it. Next week, if you'll study ahead, you'll do 51 through 55, and you know chapter 51. Chapter 52 also has an explanation, so does chapter 54. So there's three of the five Psalms next week. They're set into a framework. So if you'll study those, hopefully the Lord will teach us again next time. Father, as we sit together tonight, we're so thankful as we read through these Psalms that we serve an awesome God. And that, Lord, you are never far away and you are never unwilling to help and you aren't cut off from your people, but you desire very much, like you did in the days of Hezekiah, to teach us that we can rely upon you when all of life seems to be falling apart. Not only are you a place of refuge, you will give us inner strength, and in the very present time of trouble, you'll be our help. So we don't need to fear even when there's cataclysm changing, because the rivers from the stream will make glad God's people. And that really is what we would remember tonight, Lord, that you would help us to learn that when you speak, when you utter your voice, as the psalmist writes, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with you, is with us, and the God of Jacob is our refuge. And we should behold the works of the Lord and be still and know that he's God. And he's the God that's with us. May we remember that tonight. May that story there in 2 Kings 18 and 19 remind us again, Lord, that though you sometimes wait long, there's nothing and no one that's going to break up or change your agenda. No amount of armies that are going to overthrow your people. No amount of enemies that are going to have an effect. We can just walk with God. And I pray we'll do that this week. And we'll have rest in our faith and trust in you. But may you remember Psalm 46. If you don't remember the rest of the Psalms, remember that one. And then remember chapter 49, verse 17. You can't take it with you. So we might use all that we have to serve the Lord. Shall we stand?
Well, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and rating our podcast. You can visit us on the web at morningstarcc.org and on our YouTube channel at morningstarcc. Again, that's at morningstarcc. If you'd like to support this podcast, please look us up at patreon.com/morningstarcc. Again, that's Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/MorningstarCC.